Hello, I'm Eric Huang. You're listening to Saint Podcast, a podcast about the always fascinating and often controversial lives of the saints. This is a history and culture podcast that explores the origins of morality tales of the saints, also known as hagiographies, and how they continue to impact life today. This is the penultimate episode in Saint Podcast's debut season, which has focused on martyrs, saints who died as a result of their beliefs. Season 2 will launch in the new year with 10 episodes about mystics, saints who experienced visions, stigmata, and exorcisms. Stay tuned for more information on Season 2. Episode 9 in our current season is about a very popular virgin saint. She's unusual in that she was married. She's the patron saint of poetry and the patron of the Archdiocese of Omaha, which incorporates areas in the American states of Nebraska and Wyoming. There is a historic basis to this saint, but the details of her life and the development of her legend after death seem linked with that of another ancient god and also medieval Christian views on music. This is the story of Saint Cecilia, the patron of music. The first surviving account of Cecilia's legend comes from Apaccio from around the year 495. Apaccio, or Passion, is the hagiography of a martyr. This Apaccio and Viragini's golden legend are our main sources for Cecilia's story. Cecilia was born sometime around 210 in Rome. She's the daughter of a well-to-do family and a Christian since birth. She lives the standard life of a wealthy girl and is devoted to her Christian religion, praying every day and night. Her family had arranged for her to marry a young nobleman named Valerian. Despite wishing more than anything to remain a virgin all her life, Cecilia is a dutiful daughter and therefore concedes to the wedding. As the nuptials approach, Cecilia fasts for several days. This is done to get closer to God, a form of intense meditation. On the day of the event, Cecilia secretly wears a hair shirt under her wedding gown of gold. A hair shirt, also called a cilice, is an undergarment made of coarse cloth. Many Christian denominations of monks and nuns wear these very uncomfortable pieces of clothing as self-imposed punishments, a reminder of sin, and a means to thwart sensual pleasures and temptations. John the Baptist, Mary Magdalene, Saint Jerome, and other hermit saints are often depicted wearing cilices. In their time, and in Cecilia's time, hair shirts were made from coarse animal hair, which irritated and inflamed the skin. For Cecilia, the hair shirt is a reminder of the promise she made to God as a child to remain a virgin. A painful reminder to prevent her emotions and desires from overcoming her during the passion of her wedding day and wedding night. During the ceremony, Cecilia is distracted. The golden legend tells us that while musical instruments from the wedding sounded, she didn't hear them at all, and instead sang in her heart to the Lord alone. It's this line from her hagiography that makes Saint Cecilia the patron of music. She's most often depicted in art sitting at or playing a piano, an organ, or a medieval wind instrument called a portive organ or an organetto. A portive organ is a portable pipe organ. It was worn over the shoulder with a strap. One hand plays the keys, while the other works the bellows to make the sound. The inclusion of a portive organ in Cecilia paintings is attributed to a word used in the original Latin version of Cecilia's hagiography. The word is organis. It was a generic term for musical instruments and didn't specifically mean an organ. Nevertheless, many translations of the Latin hagiography into English and other languages simply substituted organ for organis. This is why we so often see Cecilia playing a musical instrument despite not having any musical ability from any of her passios. And let's not forget that it was the band hired for Cecilia's wedding that played the organis. In her legend, Cecilia doesn't hear any of the music being played by the musicians at her wedding. Instead, she sings silently or prays to God.
Let my heart and my body be undefiled, O Lord, that I may not be confounded.
Even on her wedding day, Cecilia reaffirms her decision to remain a virgin till death. This is quite an unusual departure from the standard virgin martyr story. All the others we've met so far convince their parents to let them remain unwed, or defy them and run away. Cecilia, however, is now a married woman. That evening, when she and her husband Valerian retire to the bridal chamber, she stops him. She has something to confess, and he must promise to keep secret what she's about to tell him.
I have a lover, an angel of God who watches over my body with exceeding zeal. If my angel senses you are touching me with lust in your heart, he will strike you and you'll lose the flower of your gracious youth.
Valerian is willing to go along with his wife's request, but he needs proof. He wants to see the angel. If she can show him, Valerian agrees to love her with sincere love, meaning the marriage won't be consummated. But if she can't, or if the angel turns out to be just some guy, Valerian won't hesitate to run both of them through with his sword. Cecilia replies,
If you will believe in the true God and promise to be baptized, you will be able to see him. Go therefore to the third milestone from the city on the Appian Way and say to the poor people you will find there, Cecilia has sent me to you to have you show me an aged holy man named Urban because I carry secret orders for him. When you see this Urban, tell him everything I have said, and after you have been purified by him, come back to me and you will see the angel.
Valerian is to find a man named Urban, whose whereabouts are known only to the homeless people living along the Appian Way. We now know Urban as Pope Urban I, whose pontificate lasted from the year 220 to 230, although during his life he was simply the Bishop of Rome. The supremacy of the Pope over all bishops and what is now the Catholic Church wasn't established until the 6th century. We'll call Urban Bishop Urban, as this is what Cecilia would have known him as. So Valerian leaves Rome and sets out along the Appian Way. He seeks out Bishop Urban, who the golden legend tells us is hiding in the tombs of martyrs because, as a Christian and a bishop, he's a wanted man.
This doesn't hold up historically. Bishop Urban lived in a time of relative religious tolerance. The Roman Emperor Severus Alexander did not persecute Christians. Quite the opposite was true. Severus Alexander was tutored in Christianity. Although he remained a pagan, he allegedly placed images of the prophet Abraham and also of Jesus Christ in his oratory, alongside sculptures of Roman deities and classic historic figures.
Valerian eventually finds Bishop Urban and relays his story just as his wife had instructed. Upon hearing the tale, Bishop Urban looks to heaven and weeps. He cries to God, calling Cecilia, quote, a handmaiden who served God like a busy bee, the spouse whom she received as a fierce lion, she has sent to you as a gentle lamb. Suddenly, a white-haired man clothed in robes as white as snow appears out of nowhere. He holds a book with gold lettering on it. Valerian swoons and falls down as if dead. The old man in white picks Valerian up and urges him to read the words.
One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in all of us.
This line comes from the Bible, Ephesians chapter 4, verse 5. Ephesians is the 10th book in the New Testament, the epistle or letter to the Ephesians. The book is literally a letter. It's attributed to St. Paul, who may have wrote it whilst in prison. Biblical scholars are in general agreement the letter was written to be circulated to various Christian communities all over the Roman Empire, not just to those in Ephesus, as the name Ephesians would suggest. The letter was a plea and a primer from St. Paul on how to stay united as Christians in the years immediately after Christ's death. We met St. Paul in episode 1 about St. Stephen, the proto-martyr. The mysterious old man in white who appears before Valerian is thought to be St. Paul himself. He shows Valerian the verse from Ephesians,
which is in essence the Christian creed, that there is one true God, in contrast to contemporaneous religions that worship various pantheons of multiple gods. Once Valerian reads the verse, the old man in white, St. Paul, asks if Valerian believes in this one faith he's just read about. Deeply moved, Valerian cries out that indeed he does believe. St. Paul vanishes. Bishop Urban now baptizes Valerian. When Valerian returns to his wife, he finds her in their bedchamber. At her side, he sees an angel. The winged being holds two chaplets, crowns made of flowers, one of roses, the other of lilies. The angel gives one to Cecilia and the other to Valerian. We're not told which chaplet goes to whom, but the white lilies symbolize virginity, and the red roses, martyrdom. The angel speaks.
Guard these crowns with spotless hearts and clean bodies, because I have brought them to you from God's heaven. They will never wither, nor lose their sweet odor, nor can they be seen by anyone except those whom chastity pleases. And you, Valerian, since you have trusted good counsel, ask whatever you wish, and you will have it.
Cecilia's angel grants Valerian a wish. His one greatest desire is to have his brother Tiburtius at his side, a convert to Christianity. The very moment Valerian voices his wish, Tiburtius walks through the door. He remarks on a strong floral scent he detects nearby. He finds it refreshing. The aroma changes him somehow, but where is it coming from? Valerian rushes to his brother's side and explains everything: Cecilia's angel, his own baptism and conversion, and the source of the floral scent. The golden legend now continues with a long passage in which Cecilia explains her faith to Tiburtius. She argues the case for him to follow his brother and convert. During the conversation, Cecilia reveals she's destined to die a martyr. Tiburtius balks at this, but the newlyweds impress on him that a heavenly afterlife is far superior than any length of life on earth. Tiburtius is finally swayed. He follows his brother to find Bishop Urban and is baptized. When they return, Tiburtius sees Cecilia's angel, and other angels as well. The golden legend then tells us that Tiburtius obtained anything he prayed for, though we aren't given any details. Together with his brother, Tiburtius now devotes his waking hours to helping the poor and providing recently martyred Christians with a proper burial. An official named Tercius Almachius hears of the brothers' works of charity and summons them. Almachius is the local prefect, the man in charge of the Christian persecutions in this legend. The men have a debate in which the brothers argue the case for their Christian faith. Almachius thinks them ridiculous. He calls Tiburtius, quote, not right in the head. After a lengthy discourse, the prefect has had enough. He decrees that the brothers will offer sacrifice to the Roman gods in the morning and turns them over to a guard named Maximus, who seems sympathetic to their cause. As Maximus marches the brothers to their cell, he asks why they seem so eager to meet their deaths, especially when they're still, quote, in the purple of their youth. Valerian repeats his wife's argument from earlier, that their mortal lives as non-believers are nothing compared to the glory of an afterlife as Christians. The speech moves Maximus, and he converts. He, his entire household, and all the executioners and retainers are baptized that night by Bishop Urban, who visits them in secret. In the morning, the brothers are led to a shrine of Jupiter. Valerian and Tercius refuse to make sacrifice and are beheaded. Maximus sees a vision at the moment of the brothers' death. Here is the passage from the Golden Legend describing it.
Maximus swore that in the hour of the saint's passion, he had seen shining angels and the martyrs' souls going forth like virgins from the bridal chamber, and the angels carrying them heavenwards.
The word passion refers to the brothers' death, their martyrdom, which is why hagiographies of martyrs are called passios, or passions. News of Maximus's conversion soon reaches Almachius, and the prefect orders him beaten to death with leaded tongs. Cecilia has the bodies of her husband, brother-in-law, and Maximus taken away and buried in a nearby cemetery. Now, with Valerian and Tiburtius dispatched, Almachius makes plans to confiscate their lands and their fortune. Cecilia, as Valerian's surviving heir, who would also inherit Tiberius's estate given Valerian's death, is in the way. So the prefect has her arrested on charges of being a Christian. Like her husband and brother-in-law, she's ordered to make sacrifice to the Roman gods or face death. Cecilia's servants and sympathetic onlookers cry out. They beg her to comply rather than die. She's still so young and has all her life ahead of her. Cecilia replies,
"Good folks, I'm not losing youth but exchanging it, giving up clay and receiving gold, abandoning a hut for a palace, leaving a narrow corner of the street for a wide-open, light-filled plaza. If someone offered you a gold piece for a copper, would you not accept it readily? God indeed gives back to us 100 for 1. Do you believe what I'm saying?"
Everyone present, a crowd of over 400 people, declares that they believe. Once again, Bishop Urban arrives in secret to baptize the hundreds of people just converted by Cecilia's speech. Presumably, Cecilia has been allowed to go home, because the golden legend tells us Almachius summons her a second time. This time, he questions her directly about her religion. They debate and trade insults. Almachius calls Cecilia presumptuous and accuses her of arrogance. She likens him and his earthly power to a balloon filled with wind. Prick it with a pin, and it collapses. Almachius cautions Cecilia. He reminds her that her life is in his hands. He has the power to give it or take it away. She disagrees.
"You can indeed take life away from the living, but you cannot give life to the dead. Therefore, you are a minister of death, not of life."
For Cecilia, only the Christian God can give life to the non-living. She then continues by calling Almachius blind, because he seems to be unable to see the truth she preaches.
"I don't know where you lost your eyes. What you call gods are nothing but lumps of stone, as we all see. Put your hand out and touch them, and you will know with your fingers what you can't see with your eyes."
These lines are important because much of Cecilia's early cult centers around sight and seeing, both literally and symbolically. We'll come back to this later. Almachius is now incensed. The guards take Cecilia to her home, where she's to be tortured and killed in a dry bath. Roman houses were heated by fires beneath the floor. Cecilia was to be imprisoned in her bathroom, with the fires lit under it, to suffocate her with burning hot air. Other versions of her legend describe a fire lit directly under the bath, or a bath of boiling water. No matter the method, Cecilia spends one night and one day in the bath. She's completely unharmed. In fact, she's been perfectly comfortable in the bath, as if at a spa. Almachius now orders Cecilia to be beheaded at once. The executioner strikes her neck with his axe. The blow breaks the skin, but doesn't sever the head. He then swings 2 more times to find that the head is still attached to the wounded and now bleeding neck. According to the Golden Legend, there was a rule that no more than 3 strikes were allowed by an executioner. I couldn't find any historic evidence to support this, but Almachius's executioner used up his 3 strikes and takes leave of Cecilia as she lies bleeding on the floor. Cecilia stays alive for 3 more days. Older Passios tell us she prayed that she live these 3 extra days in order to settle her affairs and gives away all her possessions to the poor. Meanwhile, throngs of pilgrims visit her and use pieces of cloth and their own clothing to soak up blood from her gaping wound to take away as relics. Pagans also line up to have a look at this magical virgin with her head nearly cut off, and she converts all of them. Close to the end, Cecilia calls for Bishop Urban one last time.
"I asked for a delay of 3 days so that I might commend all of us to your beatitude and have you consecrate my house as a church."
Cecilia bequeaths her house to God. Bishop Urban consecrates it and turns it into a church. He then arranges her body to be buried at the nearby catacombs of Calixtus. So Cecilia dies a virgin, as was always her wish. In the next millennium to follow, she'd become one of the most popular virgin saints. Especially when in 1599, over 1,000 years after her death, a sarcophagus containing her corpse was discovered. When it was opened, Cecilia's body was reported to be in perfect condition, as if she were asleep. Cecilia's house is today the St. Cecilia Church in Trastevere in Rome. There is evidence that a house might have stood on this spot in the 3rd century, and evidence for the existence of a Roman bathhouse adjacent to it. These architectural elements seem to validate the existence of the house and dry bath where Cecilia lived and died. Pope Pascal I, who rebuilt the St. Cecilia Church in the year 822, was visited by St. Cecilia in a dream when he fell asleep during a choir practice one day. Pascal, a devotee of St. Cecilia's, had been searching for her body as a relic for the church he wanted to renovate. His search, however, was in vain, and he became despondent when he learned that Astolf, king of the Lombards, had stolen the saint's body during a raid on Rome nearly 100 years earlier in 754. In the vision, however, Cecilia told the pope that King Astolf had taken the wrong body. Her body was still in Rome, and she led the pope through the catacombs of Praetextus to its location. Here's what happened next.
By God's grace, he discovered her body in the cemetery of Praetextus, which is situated outside the Appian Gate. It was clad in golden vesture and was of the body of her venerable spouse Valerian. There, too, were her linens, filled with the blood of her martyrdom. He gathered all these things with his own hands and with great ceremony placed the body of the Holy Virgin under the high altar in the church, along with Valerian, her beloved spouse, with the martyrs Tiburtius and Maximus, and the popes Urban and Lucius.
This passage comes from Liber Pontificalis, the Book of Popes, a compilation of pope biographies covering the first pope, St. Peter, through Pope Pius II, who reigned in the 15th century. The biographies are attributed to numerous writers, including St. Jerome. It's a fascinating read, full of biographies in which fact and legend mix freely. Once Pope Pascal I found the body of St. Cecilia, he had it translated or moved to his newly refurbished church in Trastevere, where Cecilia was buried in the crypt alongside her husband. In 1599, about 800 years later, Cardinal Paolo Sfandrati supervised a restructuring project to strengthen the foundations of the church. During the excavations, a sarcophagus was discovered. Inside was the incorrupt body of St. Cecilia. An incorrupt body is a perfectly preserved corpse. It's a miraculous sign of the saintliness of the deceased. St. Cecilia's dead body, buried about 1400 years ago, was as fresh as the day she died. Sculptor Stefano Maderno was commissioned to create a memorial sculpture to replicate exactly the state of the body when it was found. You can see the marble sculpture today at Trastevere. Cecilia lies on her right side, with her hands touching just below the waist. Her head is turned back, twisted and facing down to reveal a gash on the back of her neck. Her head and face are covered by an exquisitely carved veil. This veil was a piece of fabric woven from gold, found on top of the undecayed body. It looks as if Cecilia has just fallen asleep, or maybe she's crying into her pillow. The sculpture is absolutely beautiful, and worth a visit to Rome just to see this one work of art. There's no mention of St. Cecilia prior to the 5th century, not in any of the martyrologies, which are lists of martyrs and the days of their celebrations. It's this conspicuous absence, then sudden appearance, that has led many Catholic scholars to question the historicity of this saint. Hippolyte Delahaye, a well-regarded Jesuit scholar, called the legend of St. Cecilia, quote, "the most tangled question in all Roman hagiography." Delahaye was appointed to be a fellow of the Society of Bollandists, a Jesuit organization set up to research and verify the thousands of hagiographies and cults of saints that had developed since the birth of Christianity. Delahaye questions the authenticity of the corpse at Trastevere. First of all, the catacombs where Pascal found the body in the 9th century, the catacombs of Praetextus, are not the location specified by any of her passios. According to these stories, it's the catacombs of Calixtus where she was buried. Secondly, the section where the body was found in the Praetextus catacombs dates to nearly 200 years after Cecilia's death, and 100 years after the Edict of Certica and the Edict of Milan, which officially ended Christian persecutions in both halves of the Roman Empire. The body Pascal found buried in the catacombs of Praetextus could not have been the body of a martyr or the body of Cecilia. There's also the matter of her head. According to church records, Pope Pascal had the head removed and translated to the Church of the Four Crowned Ones in 821. There are no records indicating the return of the head back to Trastevere. Delahaye also examined the condition of Cecilia's corpse. When it was first discovered by Pope Pascal I, he didn't mention an incorruptible corpse. If Cecilia's body had been found in perfect condition with no signs of decay, the Pope would have absolutely broadcast the news very widely. Note that the description from Liber Pontificalis we just heard earlier only mentions golden clothing and bloodied linens. There's no mention at all about her body or any lack of decay. If the body discovered by Pope Pascal I in the 9th century was the body of St. Cecilia, it's highly unlikely that the reportedly incorrupt body found in 1599 is the same one. A handful of eyewitness accounts from the 1599 discovery have survived. The official report, produced several days after the sarcophagus was opened, mentions specifically an incorrupt face and hands. Eyewitness accounts written on site describe fabric obscuring the face and hands, and not gold fabric, just, quote, a heap of fabric, blocking the body from view. An eyewitness's drawing of the body has been archived in the Vatican Library. The illustration shows a corpse on its back, face up, not rolled over to the right side in the dramatic pose depicted by Maderno's wonderful sculpture. And lastly, the corpse was recorded in 1599 as being, quote, 5.5 palms long. The palms refer to hand lengths, and works out to be about 4 feet, or just shy of 1.25 meters, which suggests that the corpse in the sarcophagus in Trastevere was the body of a child, not a grown woman. For Jesuit scholar Hippolyte Delahaye, the historic evidence is clear. The body in Trastevere is that of a mummified child, not the incorrupt body of St. Cecilia. Delahaye's theory is that King Astolf and the Lombards did indeed steal Cecilia's body in 754 and took it far away from Rome. Today, churches in Paris, Beauvais, and Tours all claim to have Cecilia's head and other body parts in their possession. Maybe these are loot from King Astolf's raid. Although the body in Trastevere is very unlikely to be that of St. Cecilia's, it's possible she's based on a historic person. Delahaye and also academic Thomas Connolly proposed that there was a wealthy woman named Cecilia, a Christian holy woman. When she died, she gave her property to the church, and given her standing in society, had the privilege of being buried in the catacombs. Women in ancient Rome named Cecilia, Cecilia in Italian, were generally members of the Caecili family. The clan traces its legendary roots to Vulcan, god of fire. The word volcano is derived from the god's name. Vulcan was the blacksmith of the Olympian gods and the husband of Venus. The family name comes directly from one of Vulcan's sons, Caeculus, which means blind little boy. This is a reference to his legend in which the boy was unharmed by a fire, then found he had the power to control it. But the smoke from the fire blinded him, then stunted his growth. Like Caeculus, Caecili means blind. The name Cecilia, which derives from Caecili, means the blind one. The Golden Legend explains that this moniker alludes to Cecilia's blind faith in the Christian God, and how her faith is an antidote to spiritual blindness. Cecilia cures blindness by helping pagans become Christians. Sight is a recurring theme in Cecilia's hagiography. There are numerous passages of figurative blindness describing pagans who are blind to the Christian faith, and passages describing how Cecilia helps them to see. Recall the line from the Golden Legend when Cecilia addresses Almachius.
I don't know where you lost your eyes. What you call gods are nothing but lumps of stone, as we all see. Put your hand out and touch them, and you will know with your fingers what you can't see with your eyes.
According to Thomas Connolly, it's this emphasis on seeing that links Cecilia to the cult of an ancient goddess centered at the current site of the St. Cecilia Church in Trastevere. Some of the stones from the ancient Roman bath that existed before the church, and are now part of the church's contemporary structure, have inscriptions on them, referencing the restoration of a shrine to Bona Dea, the good goddess. The shrine was in the vicinity of Trastevere, likely attached to the baths. Bonadea was an ancient god that predated the Roman Empire. She was associated with chastity, fertility, and healing. She was also known as Fauna, a god of the wilderness, who was the wife of Faunus, another wilderness deity. Bonadea, or Fauna, rejected the advances of her husband because she wanted to remain a virgin despite marrying him. This is just like Cecilia and Valerian. Bonadea was worshipped exclusively by women. Men weren't allowed to enter her sacred spaces on pain of death. Festivals in her honor were the only recorded events in ancient Rome where women were allowed to drink strong, sacrificial-grade wine and cavort through the night without the company or supervision of men. Bonadea's shrine at present-day Trastevere was special in that it focused on her healing talents, in particular, to cure ailments of the eyes and blindness. Thomas Connolly makes a convincing argument that the healing shrine of Bonadea morphed into the cult of Cecilia as Christianity replaced traditional religions to become the official faith of the Roman Empire. The Bonadea shrine to cure eye ailments was very popular and continued to be in use long after paganism was outlawed. This was allowed by authorities because the shrine was now dedicated to a new divine healer, a Christian healer, the blind one, Saint Cecilia. Today, Cecilia is the patron saint of music. We discussed how the line from her Passio, that she sang in her heart, led to this connection. It wasn't until the 15th century, though, that her iconography regularly included instruments. Thomas Connolly, the academic and author I've already mentioned, has a great book about Saint Cecilia and her connection to music. It's called Mourning into Joy, and you can head to Saint Podcast's website for a link to the book. The earliest surviving images of St. Cecilia are 6th century mosaics from Ravenna. These are the same ones that feature the earliest depictions of St. Sebastian, when he was a gray-haired warrior, centuries before he became a half-naked pinup, as discussed in episode 2. Like St. Sebastian, St. Cecilia's iconography changed a lot through the ages. At Ravenna, she's indistinguishable from other virgin martyrs, all of whom have nearly the exact same face and clothing. We only know the identity of each virgin martyr because their names are included in the mosaics. Cecilia's association with music at this time, though not discernible from the mosaics, was tied to the role of music in Mass and prayer. Music had the dual symbolism of being sacred when praying and glorifying God, and also profane when it was an indulgence, a mortal pleasure. Cecilia's appreciation for music was of the sacred kind. She ignored the musical entertainments at her own wedding and instead sang in her heart to God. Several hundred years later, around the late 13th century, depictions of saints became narrative rather than just figurative. Grand cycles of paintings illustrating key moments in their hagiographies proliferated. This solidified the symbolism of attributes between saints and particular objects from their respective legends. You could now start to pick out St. Cecilia from other virgin martyrs. She's the one in the dry bath, surrounded by flames. She often wore a wedding ring, signifying her marriage to Valerian. And sometimes there appeared a falcon, a symbol of nobility. It's in the 13th century that the first musical instruments begin appearing as well. According to academic W.H. Grattan Flood, a French gilt copper sculpture of Cecilia playing a lute-like kithara was discovered in the early 20th century. The work dates to about 1220. Only a handful of other examples of Cecilia with musical instruments have survived until we get to the early 1500s. One of these is a painting by Raphael. It was commissioned for a St. Cecilia chapel at the San Giovanni in Monte Church in Bologna, Italy. The chapel and painting were commissioned by an aristocrat named Elena Duglioli dall'Olio, who was absolutely devoted to St. Cecilia. Like her patron saint, Duglioli wished to remain a virgin till death. She was married to an older man, but convinced him to keep her virginity intact, just like Cecilia. Duglioli was thought of as a living saint. She attended Mass every day and dedicated her life to charity. She also had visions of Saint Cecilia, who gave instructions on how to live a saintly life. Duglioli was so dedicated to her beloved saint that Cardinal Francesco Alidossi gave her a knucklebone relic from one of Cecilia's hands. When Duglioli died, legends sprang up all around her. She was no longer just another rich person from Bologna. She was a princess, the daughter of Mehmed the Conqueror, an historic Ottoman sultan who conquered Constantinople and effectively ended both the Byzantine Empire and the Roman Empire. He was a very big deal. According to the legends, it was Duglioli's destiny to convert the Turks and take back Constantinople for Christendom. This never happened. Through her powerful connections with church officials, Elena Duglioli was able to commission a painting for her Cecilia Chapel from the superstar Raphael. The painting was looted in 1798 and taken to Paris. In 1815, it was returned to Bologna. After cleaning and restoration, the painting was hung at the Pinacoteca Nazionale, where it remains on exhibit today. The painting is huge, over 2 meters or 7 feet tall. It shows Cecilia surrounded by other saints, Paul, John the Evangelist, Augustine, and Mary Magdalene. Cecilia holds a portive organ in her hands while looking upwards at a choir of angels singing from a hymn book. It looks as if she's about to drop the organ, and around her are the battered and broken remains of various other musical instruments. The painting is a visual representation of the duality of music and Christianity we've discussed. Cecilia has given up on the earthly pleasures of music and looks up at the angels, listening only to the music from heaven. Interestingly, the other saints look at each other and at the ground. Mary Magdalene looks directly at the viewer, as if engaging or challenging us. There are many symbols of chastity in the painting, something very important to the commissioner Duglioli and also her beloved saint. Cecilia wears a traditional Renaissance belt that symbolizes chastity. John the Evangelist, who stands just behind Cecilia to our left, is the patron saint of virginity. He was a virgin who broke off an engagement to join Jesus as an apostle. Saints Augustine and Paul both praised the virtues of celibacy in their writings. And Mary Magdalene is the repentant sinner. If you ever get the chance to visit Bologna, stop by the Pinacoteca to have a look at this painting. There's also a digital copy at the St. Podcast website. By the 17th century, musical instruments had become ubiquitous in Cecilia paintings, and St. Cecilia's association with music veered away from her hagiography. Rather than simply holding or dropping a musical instrument, she started playing them. The images resemble scenes from wealthy drawing rooms in Europe, where debutantes play the piano to entertain their parents' influential friends and to woo suitors. The performances depicted often include numerous putti, which are baby angels, who sing along to the music Cecilia plays while sat or fluttering around her. Sometimes they accompany her on instruments or help by turning the sheet music. Christ and the Virgin Mary and other saints also make appearances at the private concert, most often sat in a heavenly VIP box up above. Saint Cecilia was now a firm symbol for music. Her image became a popular alternative to the Greek muses, divinities that presided over the arts. The word music comes from the name of these Greek gods, muses. Ancient images of these spirits and another deity called Musica were often misidentified as Saint Cecilia, though these much older gods rarely played a piano or organ. Cecilia now also rivaled an older Christian musical patron, King David, the legendary ruler of Israel and Judah. This is the same David who, as a boy, defeated Goliath with a slingshot. He was often depicted in art playing his favorite instrument, a harp. In scenes of penance from King David's legend, his harp is discarded on the ground, broken at his feet, like the instruments in Raphael's painting of Cecilia. Again, we see the two faces of music, sacred and profane. The broken harp symbolizes King David's contrition. He has relinquished his earthly pursuits and pleasures and looks up to God. There are a fair few artworks in celebration of music showing David and Cecilia. He had his harp she at her organ. Cecilia's popularity as a musical saint reached its height in the 17th century, with the proliferation of concerts all over Europe dedicated in her honor, even in Protestant England. Between the years 1683 and 1700, annual St. Cecilia celebrations on her feast day, the 22nd of November, saw poets like John Dryden and Alexander Pope, and composers Henry Purcell and George Friedrich Handel create works in her honor. Because England was Protestant, the celebrations were strictly secular. Nevertheless, these concerts were important dates in the social calendar. Cecilia's association with music continues in the modern era. Paul Simon wrote the song Cecilia, performed by Simon and Garfunkel, in 1970. The lyrics bemoan the emotional stress of an ambivalent lover who runs hot and cold. Simon has suggested that it's an allegory about music itself. The inspiration behind creating music that comes and goes like a frustrating, capricious lover. Simon wrote about Cecilia again in the 1990 song, The Coast. On November 23, 2015, one day after St. Cecilia's feast day, the Foo Fighters released an EP entitled St. Cecilia. It was a free digital download, a gift to their fans, and dedicated to the victims of the terrorist attacks in Paris that October. The EP was named after the single St. Cecilia, which the band recorded while staying at the St. Cecilia Hotel in Austin. The hotel is named after the patron saint of music because of Austin's long association with music. From South by Southwest, which debuted in 1987, to the long-running music TV show Austin City Limits, which first aired in 1974. Willie Nelson was the first guest. St. Cecilia is the fictional setting of the 2017 Pixar film Coco. It's all about music. The protagonist, Miguel, dreams of becoming a guitar hero like his idol Ernesto de la Cruz, much to the chagrin of his parents. Miguel accidentally ends up in the land of the dead. He receives help from musician ancestors to bring him back to the mortal world and bring music back to his family. Saint Cecilia also appears in literature, most famously perhaps in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Written between 1387 and 1400, Chaucer's classic is a collection of 24 stories told by pilgrims to pass the time as they travel together from London to Canterbury, a well-worn path for Christian pilgrims. Cecilia's legend appears in the Second Nun's Tale. Chaucer's version is a faithful retelling of the Golden Legend hagiography and the only hagiography in the Canterbury Tales. Its inclusion shows just how popular St. Cecilia was. Cecilia, Memoirs of an Heiress, is a 1782 novel by author and playwright Frances Burney. The protagonist is an orphaned heiress named Cecilia Beverley, who navigates the treacherous waters that was 18th century London society. The author was the daughter of a musician and grew up surrounded by music. Her novel is a critique of the rigid rules governing gender, particularly in musical settings, from private performances in salons to the opera, that the protagonist adores with all her heart and soul. It's at the opera where Cecilia Beverley feels truly herself, when in reality, it's not a safe place at all. Male attendees like the unwanted suitor Sir Robert Floyer saunter up and down an aisle at the opera known as Fop's Alley, so designated to allow men an opportunity to openly scrutinize the single ladies, who must remain seated. Like St. Cecilia, Cecilia Beverley is a woman thrust among people who try to force her off the path she has chosen. It's partially through the personal enjoyment of music that she finds solace, and sometimes strength, to persevere and eventually succeed. For St. Cecilia, success is following the will of the Christian God, who calls on her to die a virgin martyr. For Cecilia Beverley, her fate is also to die in a sense. She ends up marrying Mortimer, a man she loves, whose very name means death. In the midst of it all, it's the music in their hearts that inspires and drives both Cecilias. In 1854, Charles Dickens' Hard Times was published. It features a heroine named Cecilia, nicknamed Sissy. Sissy is from the circus. Her father abandons her, hoping she'll have a better life outside the circus than in. Sissy's teacher, a rather emotionless man named Mr. Gradgrind, takes her in. She ends up changing the lives of the Gradgrind family, bringing her unconventional perspective and emotions. Musical allusions abound in the text. Academic Barbara Witticky reads Hard Times as Dickens' ode to the spirit of music, the harmony Sissy brings to those in the Gradgrind family who will hear it. And it's harmony, I think, that St. Cecilia represents in the 21st century. Her legend is replete with a harmonious blend of dualities. She's a modern Christian saint and an ancient pagan deity. As the muse of music, she's like a capricious lover, nurturing one moment, then all at once, distant, unavailable. She represents music in its two antithetical forms, sacred silent prayer and sinful audible pleasure. Through her, both are celebrated around the world. Her legend has inspired characters in literature out of step with her contemporaries, who bring about a harmony through change, persuading those who were once blind to finally see. Thank you so much for listening to episode 9 in St. Podcast's Martyr Season, St. Cecilia, the Patron of Music. This episode is dedicated to a special Cecilia, my mom. This one's for you, Mama. The readings in this episode were provided by my cousin, who's also named Cecilia, Cecilia Koo, who lives in Houston, Texas. The musical interludes were composed and performed by Amy Vanacore, a talented pianist and composer and teacher from Portland, Oregon. Head to St. Podcast's website and social media pages to see images of the people, artworks, and objects covered. The email address is feedback@stpodcast.com. That's Saint spelled out, S-A-I-N-T. We would love to hear from you. The next and last episode in St. Podcast's Martyr Season is about another virgin martyr. Like Cecilia, she was born to wealthy parents in Rome. She's known for being tortured by having her eyes gouged out. And because of this, she's the patron saint of the blind and of optometrists. Celebrations for this saint mark the winter solstice, and ancient customs practiced on her feast day influenced the development of another legendary figure, Santa Claus. Tune in this December for the story of St. Lucy, the spirit of Christmas.